And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program as part of Natural Alternatives. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world, which is what the vast majority of us really do want. Well, we have a lot to talk about on this show. The topic is climate change. But we're not going to be focusing on so much of the dark and heavy part of it. We're going to be focusing on solutions. That's right. At a time when it seems like our elected officials are nowhere near coming to grips with the ongoing climate crisis, we're going to be talking about a potentially bipartisan solution that's currently being discussed in Washington, D.C. It's a bill entitled the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, or H.R. 763. It's not as controversial as the Green New Deal. It's not out there in the news as much in the mainstream media, but it's out there. And that's by design, in terms of not being controversial, because it's being put forth as something that can actually, in theory, appeal to politicians on both sides of the aisle. The group that's behind this act is called Citizens Climate Lobby. And we're happy to have with us their New York State coordinator, Lynn Meyer. Lynn is a semi-retired psychologist who has spent the past 7 years volunteering for climate advocacy, first with White Roof Project and then with Citizens Climate Lobby, where she serves as co-leader of the Queens Nassau chapter and New York State co-coordinator. CCL, or the Citizens Climate Lobby, is an international bipartisan nonprofit with over 150,000 supporters worldwide. Their mission is to create the political will for a livable world. For the past 10 years, their volunteers have lobbied members of Congress in support of a carbon fee and dividend policy, championed by renowned climate scientist Dr. James Hansen, who serves on their advisory board. Late last year, this policy was introduced in both houses as a bipartisan bill called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. This year, it was reintroduced in the House, where it has 60 co-sponsors, one of whom is actually a Republican. Lynn, thank you for joining us on The Healthy Planet.
Bob, thanks so much for having me. It was so great meeting you at the Clean Energy Leadership Forum, which is such a great place for all the clean energy organizations to network.
It's true. And I give credit to the Sustainability Institute, Neil Lewis, for creating all of those opportunities for all of us to learn and coordinate and create good things together. And he's been at it for so many years. Lynn, I mentioned in my intro that you spent the past 7 years volunteering doing climate advocacy. And I know from seeing what you do and from being a volunteer of one sort or another for several decades that this is not an every so often kind of volunteering that you've been engaged in. So tell our audience what motivated you to step into this role and why have you stuck it out for so many years?
Well, Bob, I retired from my day job as a school psychologist 9 years ago, although I still maintain a small private practice, and I began looking for a way to make a difference in the world. I reached out to progressive organizations because I am a progressive, but I ended up working in a bipartisan organization that I believe in very deeply because I don't think that one party alone can pass legislation that can last. They could pass legislation that might be undone by the next administration. So for CCL, it's always been important that we introduce something bipartisan, which has a much better chance of sticking. And I think that's what people on both sides miss, that the country is deeply divided right now. We're in a very highly partisan era. And we need to get back to the days when people from both parties could go to a bar together on Friday night and do those smoke-filled backroom deals together, which are dirty and they're sausage-making. No one wants to know what's in them. But today we seem to be in an era where each side feels it has the moral high ground and therefore it's not going to compromise with the other side. So we have managed to find a group of members of Congress who are willing to cross that big aisle. It started with the Climate Solutions Caucus several years ago, and anyone who's interested can check out our TV episode, Years of Living Dangerously, Season 2, Episode 7. Bradley Whitford is in it. And it's all about how we got the Climate Solutions Caucus started, which is it's sometimes known as the Noah's Ark Caucus because members of Congress join as pairs, one Democrat, one Republican. It's become uneven, especially after the 2018 election, because fortunately or unfortunately, a lot of these moderate Republicans lost their seats. So it's now, I think, about two-thirds Democrat, but we're continuing the policy of having only pairs join.
That's an interesting way of doing it.
Yeah.
I see the wisdom.
Very exciting. Yeah, and if you tune into our episode, you'll see an actual lobby meeting with one of our Long Island congressmen, Lee Zeldin, who is a staunch Republican.
Yes, he is.
And he's very staunch Republican. However, he was convinced to join the Climate Solutions Caucus. And in our episode, he actually says that he will join, and he did. And so did Peter King.
Being from Long Island, I guess they have to represent the people who elected them into office. So despite the fact that they have some pretty horrific environmental records, that's heartening to hear.
They do, but you might be surprised to know that Pete King is actually considered one of the most moderate Republicans in Congress. I was in his D.C. office in June, and I asked his longtime aide whether he feels that the constituents of New York 2 care about climate change. Are they concerned? And he said, oh, yeah. They're concerned. They get it. They've been through Hurricane Sandy. Many of them have not fully recovered.
Yeah.
And they understand the risks.
Absolutely. So let's go back and start with some basics before delving into some of the solutions. Share with our audience some of what you think about when you think of the impacts of climate change on the country.
Oh, goodness. Which, honestly, I try not to think about more than necessary because it's very deeply depressing.
It certainly can be.
When I read the news, and I read an awful lot about climate change, it's most of what I read, and on Facebook, I get to see articles posted by a lot of my fellow CCLers. I have about 800 Facebook friends, and all we really talk about is climate change.
Yeah.
So I get to see a lot of articles, and I always feel like I'm on a roller coaster because it's the bad news, the good news, the bad news, the good news. The bad news is honestly horrific. It's horrific. The planet is in, I can't possibly exaggerate the level of emergency that we are in. There are legitimate scientists who believe in near-term human extinction, one in particular. Most are not saying that, but they are saying that in the worst-case scenario, which would be, say, 6 degrees Celsius of warming by 2100, the planet would be virtually uninhabitable.
Yeah.
And frankly, Mars is no better. That's not an answer. Mars has no oxygen and freezing temperatures, so I'm not interested in going to Mars. We have to fix this planet, and we can. And I want our listeners to know, Bob, that it's not hopeless. There's a lot of people out there who feel that it's hopeless when they see the reports of the horrific events that are going on. The wildfire season on the West Coast is now all year long. It's just many, many times over what it used to be. And what could be more of a nightmare than the thought of a wildfire suddenly descending on your town in a matter of less than a minute with no warning?
Right, and destroying whole towns.
Yes, horrific. And, of course, we're all aware of sea level rise, which is showing itself in sunny day flooding.
That's right.
In Miami, when they have a king tide, a very high tide, people are up past their ankles in water in the streets and on the sidewalks. And even more serious to our country, Norfolk, Virginia, is having extreme flooding situations to the point that they are having to close the schools maybe 10 days a year lately, and people are in boats in the streets. And Norfolk, Virginia is the home to the world's largest naval installation. So that becomes a national security issue.
Absolutely. Yeah, we see it every day, and it is an emotional roller coaster to actually watch the news. You see what's going on with the storms and the fires and the droughts, and then you see the Amazon on fire, and then you see regulations being removed that create just the opposite effect of what we need. And it's difficult. And I think a lot of people in this country, and I guess on this planet, are experiencing this emotional roller coaster, seeing that their life support system is changing and that the powers that be are not necessarily interested in stemming the tide. So it's a tough period.
It sure is. When I think of what lies ahead, things that my children will witness that I won't in the decades to come,
yeah,
there will be droughts and famines all over the world, especially sub-Saharan Africa. Already you're seeing climate migration, where people are leaving their homes because they can't farm anymore and they can't make a living. The crisis in Syria is believed to have been triggered by a drought.
Yeah.
And a lot of the migration from Africa into Europe is climate driven. And there are no protections for climate migrants the way there are for refugees from wars. Climate refugees have no protections. And this is going to become a huge problem.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk about hundreds of thousands of people coming from Central America, causing what is deemed to be a country-threatening crisis. But in fact, if you think about the Himalayan region and those glaciers melting and those rivers getting lower and drying up, you're talking about migrants in the billions, potentially. So yeah, the differences that could be created in our world are just really unfathomable.
They really are, Bob. It's so tragic to think of what is going to be happening and has begun happening in Bangladesh, in the Pacific Islands, and here in this country. We all know about sea level rise, but I had not expected flooding in the Midwest from lakes and rivers, flooding from the Great Lakes that's happening right here in New York State.
Yeah, and storms that don't move, that just sit on top of an area, causing biblical rainfall. And once-in-a-lifetime storms happening every couple of years or every year, and just records being broken all the time. So that's what we're in the middle of. That's the canvas from which your efforts have sprung. So for those who are not regular listeners to this program, because a lot of people are driving home from work and they've flipped on this station, maybe they haven't researched the topic either. How do we know that human activity is causing climate change?
Sure. Well, first of all, scientists have known about the heat-trapping properties of carbon dioxide since the 1880s. They could actually demonstrate it in a jar. Mm-hmm. So we know that carbon dioxide traps heat. We also know that since the Industrial Revolution began, we have been emitting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere in tons and tons, just enormous quantities. And so the effect is a blanket over the earth that traps the heat. And what we see in the rising temperatures resembles a hockey stick graph as Al Gore showed us all in 2006, much to our horror, that temperatures had been, you know, kind of cycling, rising a little bit, not rising, maybe not rising a little bit steadily, and then suddenly, about 200 years ago, you see them take off almost vertically, and we're seeing this humongous rise in temperatures. Now, people will say, okay, what's a degree here or there? Well, it makes a huge difference. The scientists have known this for a long, long time. Dr. James Hansen, who was the head of one of the divisions of NASA and then had to leave because he came out and spoke publicly about climate change, and then he became affiliated with NYU. He's on our advisory board. He wrote a book in the 1980s called Storms of My Grandchildren that predicted everything we're seeing now. And he spoke before Congress in 1988, warning everyone about what was taking place and what could be predicted. Sadly, people apparently have to see it for themselves in order to believe it. Now, Americans believe that climate change is happening. About 70% of us do, according to the latest polling by Yale, the Yale School of Climate Communications. And more than half of us want government to act on climate. So although we don't see any desire, very little desire on the Republican side of the aisle in Congress, we do see it in the population at large. People in general get it, and especially young people. And there are young Republican clubs across the country on college campuses who are advocating for climate policies. And we have many of them among our midst at Citizens Climate Lobby.
Yes, they are. The young Republicans are getting it. And the old Republicans, not so much. But, you know, but that's hopeful. The fact that, you know, the young Republicans are growing up, they're seeing what's going on, and it's undeniable. And they're smart people. You know, they're aware and they know how to look at science, and they're getting the picture. So eventually, and this is, I'm not guessing at this, eventually the Republicans will come around and they will grasp it and they will acknowledge it, and it will be part of their platform as well. But for the moment, it isn't. We're at a very odd point in history when you can deny something that's so obvious and so major, and then your main task becomes to make sure that the people who are electing you also stay similarly misinformed. And that's an odd scenario right there, but that will change. I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, the fossil fuel industry is one of the most powerful and wealthiest in the country, and they have for decades created a climate of misinformation. And lots of people want to hold them accountable for that. Myself, I'd rather stay focused on passing legislation that can actually get passed.
Sure.
And, yeah, to the people on the left who are not happy with our revenue-neutral approach, I would say we want something passed. It may not be the perfect solution, the solution that you would love to have, but we're in a planetary crisis, the likes of which has never been seen, and spending time debating which exact policies should be passed is like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. We need to get something passed.
Yeah, indeed. And for people on Long Island, we obviously have a history now with the potentially from climate change with Hurricane Sandy. What other impacts on Long Island are predicted to be taking place as the result of climate change or the surrounding areas?
Long Island is a coastal community, so sea level rise is huge. But some of the same impacts that we're seeing across the state and the country, I think, are noticeable. The increase in precipitation. There's just more precipitation, which is because if you warm the air, it holds more moisture.
That's right.
And then it drops more moisture. The ocean currents are changing. more warming is happening in the ocean than on land. So we're seeing a complete change in the ocean currents, which affects the wind currents, and you're seeing things that we haven't seen before, like tornadoes in our area. There was a huge tornado in Bayside a few years ago with big trees all over the streets. I have just never seen anything like this. And I haven't read anything about this one, Bob, but I've been seeing lightning storms that are very bizarre. Have you noticed this, like lightning storms where every few seconds there's a flash of lightning for an hour?
I've been watching the storms, but I am not able to tell whether it's a difference from now, from 20 years ago or not. But I will tell you that I was out just amongst people, not amongst people who are working with me on health and environmental issues. And more than a couple of people were commenting about the weird rains that we've been having, the volume of the rains and how they come so quickly and leave so quickly and how it's unusual. And I could tell they weren't talking about it as if it was climate change, but they were just saying, what's going on with the weather? So things are changing. That we know.
Yeah, I do find the weather to be less predictable. I find that even the Weather Channel is not getting it right more of the time, and it's changing very rapidly.
Yeah. And this, of course, we touched upon the mass migrations that could take place. And that, of course, can create national security issues to the degree that it's hard to even imagine what would take place if we did have the mass migrations that are possible in a world where one's water supply is no longer there for entire populations.
Well, lack of water would cause the most desperate situation imaginable. And people who don't have food, and particularly if they don't have enough water, will do anything. They will be desperate, and they will do whatever it takes to keep their families alive. There are already populations that have relied on fishing, say, off the coast of South America, where the fish populations have declined dramatically, and they are having to find new locations. If anybody wants to see some really dramatic evidence of climate change, the two documentaries, Chasing Ice and Chasing Coral. Chasing Coral, bring your tissues, because it's so sad. It's showing all the die-off of coral reefs that is happening around the world. So you want to go scuba diving, do it now.
Yeah. So if you're watching climate news, it can appear that every time a major study is released, and the news is actually really happening more rapidly, news stories about climate change. But what we're seeing is that the climate crisis is always portrayed in the newest studies as worse than we thought it was, or it's accelerating faster than previously predicted. And part of this is not due to the fact that the scientists just totally got it wrong, but it's due to the fact that the scientific community has gone out of its way to err on the side of being conservative in their predictions. So seeing this relentless onslaught of frightening predictions on top of the seemingly daily manifestations of extreme weather and the droughts and the weird rainfalls and everything else, are you hopeful about how this is going to play out?
I am hopeful. Maybe it's just in my DNA, Bob. I'm a generally optimistic person.
Yeah, I share that DNA with you.
Yeah, it's better for your mental health, even if we're deluded. There was a great quotation I love, which is that optimists are usually wrong, but all the greatest advances that mankind has done have been done by optimists. So, yes, I'm optimistic for the distant future. The sad fact is that the next few decades is going to get worse, because of what we have already done, what we've already baked into the system.
Yeah, true.
But climate change can be reversed. One of our CCL people out on the West Coast, who is a physicist, has started another organization that discusses the kind of extreme technology that may be required in the future to actually reverse climate change. We hope it doesn't come to that. there is a lot of technology out there, but we certainly can't rely on technology alone.
No.
But why am I optimistic? Because in between all the bad news about climate change is all the good news about clean energy. And this is what we have to do to halt the progression of climate change, is to simply stop putting carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere and start changing our lifestyles to rely on clean energy.
Yep.
And there's progress being made every day with that, and that is progressing faster than anticipated.
It is. And it's simple. We don't need any new technology. We don't need a new way of thinking about things. We just need to put into action what we already know. And that could be done. If we had the political will to do it, it could be done tomorrow. You know, we could start a major, major campaign that could change everything right away. But here we are. You know, we're talking about the fact that it is possible. So that's a hopeful note. And let's get into what your organization is all about and the solution that's on the forefront of your efforts. To start with, describe your organization, Citizens Climate Lobby.
Sure. So Citizens Climate Lobby was started 10 years ago, and it was based off the methods of an organization called Results that has managed to increase government monies going to microloans to help people in poor communities get their own businesses going, and has been highly successful. They organized congressional district by congressional district to influence their members of Congress. And we've done the same thing. Our chapters cover every congressional district, and we have a method of what we call polite persistence, where we keep showing up and keep bringing our message as often as we can. We're always respectful. We start every lobby meeting with appreciation, thanking the member of Congress for something they have done. And however bad you may think your member of Congress is, they've surely done something you can thank them for, whether it's a school lunch program or anything. And then we try to make connections. What do we know about their personal life? What can we connect with from our personal lives? Oh, you were a Boy Scout leader, so was I. This kind of connection that bridges the gaps between people of different political persuasions.
Yeah, that's smart.
Yeah,
so that's smart, making that connection.
Making connections and then just returning. And we'll usually have a primary ask, which in this case is going to be always, will you co-sponsor our legislation, which I'll describe.
Yep.
But if they're not ready for that, we'll make a secondary ask, such as, would you request a briefing on this bill for your committee, or something like that? Or would you discuss climate solutions with members of the Climate Solutions Caucus? Or would you like to have a meeting with business leaders in your community about climate change solutions, something like that.
That's good. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Always have an ask there. So we're talking about HR 763. Describe what that is and what mechanism would kick in if that was actually passed.
Sure. So HR 763, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, was first introduced last November in both houses, the Senate and the House, because at that time they had a Senate Republican on board, which was Jeff Flake, who is a personal friend of Chris Coons. And together they introduced it in the Senate, but Jeff Flake unfortunately retired from the Senate. So there's not been another Senate Republican to step forward. So at this point, it's only been reintroduced in the House, and the Republican on board is Francis Rooney from Florida, the state which you could call ground zero for climate change in this country. So a lot of the Florida Republicans get it, some of them anyway, depending on where their campaign money comes from. Carlos Curbelo was a climate hero among Republicans who helped found the Climate Solutions Caucus, and he lost his seat in 2018. So he's now doing a lot of TV commentary, but doing what he can from the outside to promote climate advocacy. Mm. The same thing with Bob Inglis, who was a South Carolina Republican who several years ago said he just couldn't keep quiet about this anymore and said that, yes, we needed to act on climate, and promptly lost his seat. But he has since gone on to found the organization Republic N, E-N, which is a conservative organization promoting climate change solutions. And he is on our advisory board, as is Catherine Hayhoe, who has a TV show. She is a evangelical climate scientist from Texas who is able to break through with evangelical audiences because she's one of them, and her husband is an evangelical pastor.
That's important.
Yeah. So their approach, of course, is going to be stewardship of the earth. God gave us this beautiful planet to take care of, and we need to do that.
Right.
Which is the same message that Pope Francis put out in his encyclical several years ago.
That's right. It just makes sense. But again, we're at a time where things that make sense are not necessarily manifesting, because there is this very odd mix of misinformation and intentional deception, I think, with the vast majority of Republicans and conservative people who are following Republican leaders. They are simply misled or uninformed. But from the higher ups, I can only guess whether it's being misinformed or intentionally misleading. And of course, we could guess about all the money that there is in politics, but that would all be conjecture, and I'll leave that alone. So getting to H.R. 763, tell us about it.
Sure. It's called Carbon Fee and Dividend. It is a revenue-neutral carbon tax. We call it a fee because in this policy, none of the money is kept by the government. 100% of the revenue would be returned to all American households on an equal basis per capita. The revenue would be collected by a separate agency and distributed via primarily electronic checks, the same way food stamps, tax return money, all kinds of distributions, the stimulus checks that came out in 2009. The government knows how to distribute money, and it can do that. The reason that we want a revenue-neutral policy is most Republicans in Congress have signed a no-new-taxes pledge. They will not vote for any new taxes that are not offset by something else.
Right.
So this is a tax that is offset by a dividend. The population doesn't understand this concept, or we also hear that they don't trust it. They don't think that the government will really do it. They've heard that the government raided Social Security, for example.
Right.
Our plan is, in this bill, to have the first dividend checks go out even before the fee takes place, so that people will see a dividend check, and we would like it to be distributed monthly rather than on an annual basis, as Canada did. By the way, Canada has carbon pricing throughout their country now. It just started this year. British Columbia had it for 10 years, and their economy has grown slightly better than the rest of their country. Hmm. And Canada's default program for their provinces is carbon fee and dividend. And the people are very happy. They all got their first dividend checks with their tax returns this spring. It was about $240, which is very minimal, but it will increase every year.
Right.
In our bill, the
fee will increase as well.
Yes, it does. In this bill, in H.R. 763, the fee starts very low at $15 a ton, which is a very low price, but it increases by $10 a ton every year. so that in 10 years, it's a significant over $100 a ton, and it's estimated that you would need $135 a ton to really make a significant drop in carbon emissions. So what happens is people don't understand the basics of this. The fee is imposed on the companies that dig the oil and gas and coal out of the ground. They all know, and the government knows, how many tons of carbon dioxide they emit. These are known figures. So it's very easy to administer. It's very easy to impose this fee on these companies, and you would impose this fee at the borders for products coming into the country that have not been taxed in their own countries. It's called a border adjustment. So I'd like to put this out there that some of the progressive organizations like to call this kind of thing a polluter penalty or polluter fee. I feel that's a little bit disingenuous because, frankly, we're all polluters. They sell the stuff, but we buy it and use it.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, yes, we're going to impose the fee on the corporations, but don't think for a minute that they're not going to pass the cost down to us. So gasoline goes up, your heating fuel goes up, and not only that, but all of your products that have been manufactured using fossil fuels or transported using fossil fuels, the prices of all of those things in your life are going to go up, and that is virtually everything.
Yeah.
And that is why it's so important to have legislation like this that is economy-wide. So there's a million little things that you can talk about that people can do, but most people are not doing them because they're inconvenient and they cost extra money, which most people don't have. So to get people to change the heating system of their home, that's a big ask. Even asking them to buy an electric stove instead of a gas stove, that's a big ask for most people. So what gets people to do these things is when you level the playing field between fossil fuels on the one hand and clean energy sources on the other. So when using gas as your home heating becomes more expensive, then you might look into solar panels, buying clean electricity, geothermal, or electric heat pumps, which I've seen. I noticed them in locations lately. You have to know what you're looking for, but sometimes you'll see these Mitsubishi things high up on the wall, and they are both heating and cooling, and they're completely electric. And I've just been reading, at least what Mitsubishi says, is that they will eventually save you $1,000 to $2,000 a year. And that savings is going to be that much more if the price of natural heating gas goes up.
Right. And then, of course, the king and the all-star and the low-hanging fruit of all of this is energy efficiency. You put that into effect, once the price of energy goes up, there's a lot more motivation to take on energy efficiency measures that aren't so expensive to begin with, but can save huge percentages on your heating and cooling bill and electricity bill.
That's right. And if people start receiving dividends, which will start in the hundreds per year, like $480 a year, I think, for the first year for the average family of four, they will go up into the thousands per year. And that becomes a nice chunk of money that people can use to accomplish things like this, weatherproofing, other energy efficiency measures, new thermostats, things of that nature that require upfront costs that people may not have in their pockets right now.
Right. And just to point out, this isn't a fee coming from nowhere. We're taxing you because you're bad. This is a fee that's based upon the fact that, look, these companies are putting into the air pollutants that kill perhaps up to 200,000 Americans. According to the World Health Organization, upwards of 4 million related deaths from pollution every single year around the globe. There is a price that the American public is bearing, that people all over the world are bearing, as the result of the burning of these fossil fuels. Now, in a free market economy, a company would pay for the resources it's using. Well, those who favor a free market economy are not necessarily in favor of having these corporations pay for the pollution they're causing. They're using our resource. They're using our air, our water, our lands. And so it's really an equitable payback based upon an enormous toll that is being paid by the American public. I'll add one more tidbit onto the economic benefit, air pollution control. In 2017, the Lancet Commission on Pollution and Health reported that in the United States, air pollution control pays off at a rate of 30 to 1. That means every dollar spent on air pollution control pays back $30. That's quite something.
It really is. And that's the health care costs, I assume.
Absolutely.
You're talking about. And yeah, a carbon fee like this would save many lives of people who are suffering with asthma and other air pollution related conditions.
Yep. Heart disease.
Yeah,
cancers, respiratory diseases,
yeah.
Acute lower respiratory infections. I mean, just so many things are related to air pollution. And as I mentioned in the numbers, it's a real force to be reckoned with in terms of the number of people who are dying from this. This is life and death.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, we pay for garbage pickup, right? So these companies are putting garbage into our air, and they need to pay for the consequences of that. And there are many consequences of that. There are huge economic consequences. And publications like Forbes magazine are starting to publish things about the economic consequences of climate change.
Yep.
For example, flood insurance is going up so dramatically that people are having to flee their homes because they can't afford the flood insurance.
Sure.
So one of the adaptation measures that people talk about funding, and this would be if you want to use some of the revenue for investment, one of the things you can invest in is helping people adapt to sea level rise through seawalls and relocations.
Mm.
But I also wanted to mention the concept of a Pigouvian tax, which is a tax on behaviors that we would like to decrease. Perfect example is a cigarette tax.
Sure.
They found that, you know, all the commercials showing lung diseases were never as effective as simply putting a tax on cigarettes.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And in fact, the emissions that go into your body from cigarettes are very similar to the emissions that come out of tailpipes.
Wow. Yeah. And if you watch the movie Merchants of Doubt, you learn that some of the people who were in the business of creating doubt about the link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer are the exact same people who are now creating doubt about climate change effects.
Sure. That's their business. That's what they're good at.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
They'll keep doing what they
yep.
do.
Well, it's not working so well anymore because people can see it all around them now.
Yes. And an educated public is less susceptible to that kind of information that is misinformation that is meant to create short-term profit at all of our expense.
I'd like to mention another concept, Bob, that is coming up more and more. We heard it from the Democratic candidates this week, environmental justice.
You know, you took the words right out of my mouth. That's where I was going next.
Great. So we all know that people who can least afford to be hit by climate impacts are the ones who are being hardest hit. There's a little bit of confusion between environmental and climate impacts, and I found that was a confusing thing about the town hall comments. Environmental impacts are from all kinds of pollution. For example, pollution from gas plants. They tend to be located in low-income communities because that's who wasn't able to keep them out of their backyard.
Sure.
Right?
Concrete plants. Coal plants.
Right. So what I have to say about that is any climate change plan is going to create environmental and climate justice, because if you get rid of gas plants, you're going to be helping these at-risk communities. And any climate plan on a national basis or a state basis is going to get rid of pollution. One of the simplest things that could be done, for example, is electrifying school buses. We have school buses sitting on streets all throughout urban communities, polluting the air. And by electrifying those bus fleets, it could make a huge difference.
Absolutely. And who lives right near the highways? It's not the high-income people.
Yeah, another concept I want to bring up. These things just occur to me, Bob.
Sure.
Forgive me for interrupting. But
no problem.
Some people say conservatives will criticize this bill, calling it wealth redistribution. And the answer to that is, it is and it isn't. I like to say that carbon fee and dividend is progressive and conservative at the same time. So it's conservative in that it is market-based and revenue-neutral,
mm-hmm.
so Republicans can vote for it. On the other hand, it's progressive in that it helps lower-income people the most. So lower-income people have very small carbon footprints. They don't drive multiple cars or maybe not any cars. They live in apartments. They have small carbon footprints. It's the people with the big, giant carbon footprints, the people with the yachts and private jets and car garages and big, huge mansions, they are causing a lot of carbon footprint, and they will pay under this plan. However, they don't have to. They could change their lifestyles. They could change the heating source of their living spaces. They can change their transportation. They can buy the latest Tesla.
Yeah.
And end up not paying any increased costs.
Right. Now, we've also talked extensively and frequently on this show about how a clean energy economy is a job-creating economy. And the Citizens Climate Lobby states that H.R. 763 will create 2.1 million new jobs. Talk about how that happens.
It happens in a couple of ways. The most obvious one is the jobs in clean energy. Wind turbine technician is the fastest-growing job in the country. There are already far more people employed in clean energy than there are in the coal mining industry, for example, which gets so much attention. But the other thing that is counterintuitive, perhaps, is that a dividend system puts money into the hands of ordinary Americans and is a stimulating factor for the Main Street economy. So if you give middle and lower income people a dividend check, they're going to spend it right away on things
yep.
like health care, a dinner out now and then. So they are stimulating the economy right where they live and creating jobs in all sectors. And actually, health care is one of the sectors that would benefit the most.
Sure. You know, the Department of Energy, U.S. Energy and Employment Report of 2019 stated that the vast majority of electric power generation comes from natural gas, coal, and nuclear power. And together they account for about 80% of the nation's electricity. All right? So those three, 80% of the nation's electricity. On the other hand, solar and wind produce only about 8% of our electricity. Think about that. 80% of the electricity for the dirty energy, 8% from wind and solar. But solar and wind employ more people than natural gas, coal, and nuclear power combined. That gives us an idea of the staggering job-creating potential that would and will come from clean energy. As soon as we can get past thinking about the fact that it's, for some reason, wind and solar are not American. Hey, if American is putting people to work, putting people in your neighborhood to work, and then let's take another step. We're on Long Island. Long Island does not produce natural gas. We don't produce nuclear fuel. We don't produce oil. However, when people make their houses more efficient, that employs people who live on Long Island and work on Long Island and spend on Long Island. When people get solar panels, they're employing people who live on Long Island, work on Long Island, and spend on Long Island. And this goes down the road for geothermal, anything that impacts your home. So really, there's no comparison between the economic benefit to a place like Long Island, when you're talking about doing things that are specifically working on your home, compared to shipping off your money to some other country or some other state where it's producing dirty energy.
Absolutely. CCL is working at the state level in many states, New York in particular, where we just helped pass the CLCPA. And one of the points we make is that we'd like to promote energy that's produced right here in New York instead of being imported. New York banned fracking, but we still import tons of natural gas from Pennsylvania.
Sure.
And unfortunately, the downstate area is very heavily dependent on gas and oil. We have very, very minimal solar and wind, virtually no wind being used on Long Island today. Of course, we've achieved the beginnings of two major offshore wind projects through climate advocacy on the part of a bunch of organizations on Long Island that have worked together to go to the LIPA board meetings and sit there and say, we want offshore wind. We don't want another peaker plant. And it was successful.
Yeah. You know, I interviewed Tom Falcone, the CEO of LIPA, and he was talking about the fact that, hey, look, this isn't something that we're going to be waiting a long time for. They're thinking that there will be no new large fossil fuel generation taking place going forward, that time has passed, that the electricity that we'll be generating will be coming from renewable sources and smaller plants to fill needs where necessary. And with wind and solar on the horizon, and with the actions that are happening in New York State, which we actually will talk about now, that the landscape is changing in terms of our energy use, which is fantastic news. And just to mention, there was a town hall on CNN the other night where 10 presidential candidates, I think it was, were spending all night talking about climate change. Now, this is a real major development because if you'll recall, in the election with Hillary and Donald, there was very little discussion about pollution or climate change. It was a secondary, tertiary issue. Now, we've had a presidential candidate who it was his main issue, and many of them are saying it is the most important issue. So in a very short period of time, talking about hopefulness, we've come a really long way in terms of our political landscape.
We really have, and that's the heartwarming thing to see. 7 hours of TV on climate change was unimaginable. A few years ago. So, frankly, I'm not that concerned with the differences among the climate plans of the Democratic candidates, because whoever is going to be president is going to sign whatever climate plan Congress puts on their desk, and it's going to be created by Congress. But the heartwarming news is that they're talking about it.
Indeed, it is. And it is quite heartwarming, and it's a big development that you could almost not notice, because when things happen, you kind of think, well, it's always been like this. But having been closely observing this for decades, there is a big shift happening right now.
It sure is. Another thing I'd like to make our listeners aware of is that we talk an awful lot about wind and solar, and what we're referring to is power generation. It has to do with our electricity.
Yes.
But electricity only represents less than a third of our carbon emissions nationwide. And a little bit bigger than that is our transportation emissions, which brings me to electric vehicles. We really do need to get the electric cars on the road. The predictions are that they will be on the road within the next 5 to 10 years in a big way. In the next year or two, you're going to see a lot more American-made car models that are fully electric, SUVs, trucks, and so on. But we need the infrastructure. We need to get those charging stations out in the workplaces and on the highways before people are going to feel comfortable buying electric vehicles.
Yes, absolutely. That's a big part of the equation. And also globally, something that's even bigger than transportation is livestock production. dwarfing transportation and livestock production, which we've covered extensively on this show over the course of many years. But that's something that we know we don't have to wait for. We don't have to pay for. It's a solution that could be implemented in your next meal. That's a big part of it. And also geothermal. So turning home heating and cooling, changing it from the fossil fuels to electrically driven, using the heat and the coolness from the earth.
It's really amazing. It's really mind-boggling to realize that our new energy sources are free. Nobody owns the wind, the sun, or the earth.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. There will be big costs up front. Let's not kid ourselves. This is going to be expensive. But ultimately, our energy costs will go down. And the beauty of HR 763 is that it's economy-wide. We're not subsidizing this industry or that industry, picking winners and losers. What if we pick wrong, as in the Solyndra fiasco?
Right.
No, it's economy-wide. So hamburgers will go up in price, and people will eat a few less hamburgers. But it should be more costly to reflect the cost of the industry.
There was a study the EAT Commission last year, and it said that if we were actually going to eat the type of diet that is best for us in the world, Americans would need to cut their beef consumption by 84%. That's if we were just going to get to a baseline, this is what's best for us. So we're not just talking about doing things for climate change, but public education on public health. And that's something that's in the offing. You know, personally, having been involved with this environmental health world for so many years, having spoken to so many experts, having hosted so many experts, and having read so much about it, I am now a geothermal heating, cooling, solar electricity, vegan eater, as a lot of the climate change activists are actually turning. I think I'm seeing more and more with the people in our community who are large climate activists saying, look, I want my actions to match my words. I've been asking people to do this for years. I've been pointing out to governments that we need to move in this direction or that direction. How can I do that, have integrity, and still be wasting all of these resources myself? When we're talking about solar, by the way, everybody, if you get solar from day one, you can actually be saving money because the amount of your payment on your solar loan is going to be less than the amount that you would have been spending on electricity. So it's a win-win from day one. And this type of thing is growing. It's exploding in not just amongst the environmentalists or amongst the Al Gores or other celebrities who are proposing all this, but just your neighbors. I'm seeing a lot more solar around. Of course, it's been growing on Long Island and around the country by leaps and bounds. So the change is in the air.
So true. I'm a Chevy Bolt driver. I absolutely love it. For any family that has two cars, they can certainly have one car that's electric and never have to bring it to a gas station again. Simply plug it in when you get home from work and drive it away the next morning. But before we end, I know we have to end soon. I'd like to ask our listeners to please check out the Citizens Climate Lobby website. There's a wealth of information on there on every topic you can imagine related to climate change and legislation. And there are simple tools for calling, writing, and tweeting your member of Congress that can be done with a push of a few buttons. You enter your address. They show you your member of Congress, and they give you this little script, and you make the call, and it's recorded in our logs. So please check it out.
Okay, and give information about how to get there, where to go, web addresses, phone numbers, whatever it takes.
The only thing you have to remember is citizensclimatelobby.org. Once you get there, they will direct you to join, to take action, to learn more, whatever you would like to do, to donate if that's what you have time and inclination to do.
Sure. And let's just talk a little bit, since we do have an extra couple of minutes here, unexpected minutes.
Great.
Yeah, I know we could go on for another hour. Let's let's cover some of the difference between some of the terms that people have been hearing and which were discussed in the town halls that people were watching a few nights ago. cap and trade, fee and dividend,
yes.
Green New Deal,
yes.
Carbon tax. Put a little light on that and explain the differences.
Sure, Bob. So there are two types of carbon pricing. Cap and trade is one. The other one is referred to as a carbon tax or fee, which we've been talking about in terms of H.R. 763.
Right.
A cap and trade approaches carbon pricing from the opposite way. Instead of putting a fixed price on carbon, they put a regulation on carbon emissions. They say, corporations, you may emit this much, and if you want to emit more than that, you have to apply for a permit. We don't like cap and trade as much as a straight up carbon tax, and neither do the vast majority of economists, because carbon taxes are much more predictable. With a carbon tax, you can look, for example, if H.R. 763 were enacted, it goes 20 years into the future. A corporation can look at exactly what their fees will be for the next 20 years. This creates predictability, which is good for the market, good for corporations, and ultimately good for consumers. Cap and trade is far less predictable. There have been misuses of the permits. Permits are traded. There have been instances in other countries of permits being given out to one's friends, this type of thing. And nobody can really predict what the price of the permit is going to be from year to year, because nobody knows how many permits will be applied for in a particular year.
Right.
And you wanted to know about the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is aspirational. It's not a bill. It's a resolution. I am eternally grateful to the Sunrise Movement that put this forward, to AOC and Bernie Sanders for putting this forward, because it's drawn so much attention to climate change solutions and stimulating so much of the conversation that we're seeing now, and alerting people to the fact that we're in a planetary crisis, not unlike, but way, way worse, I think, than what we saw at the beginning of World War II, where we suddenly turned all our factories into producing weapons of war. And we could do the same thing for creating more clean energy solutions if we put our minds to it. So we like to say we're big fans of the Green New Deal, and 763 would advance the goals of the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal, similar to the CLCPA in New York, they're goal-setting legislations that don't give you the means to get to the end. They say, this is what we're going to do, this is our goal, and we're going to establish a committee to figure out how to do it.
And before we go, I am going to take advantage of this little bit of extra time we have. Most people don't know that cap-and-trade programs do exist. And you had mentioned what was going on in Canada. And there's a regional greenhouse gas initiative that many northeastern states are part of. And there's a new and very exciting Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act that New York just passed. So explain what that is. Give us a little good news to close off on.
Sure. Well, Reggie, the greenhouse gas initiative that you spoke of, there are 9 states in it. It's been going on for quite a while, 9 or 10 years. And we have reduced our emissions during that time, but it's more because we switched from oil to natural gas and from coal to natural gas than it is due to Reggie. Reggie amounts are very minor. It impacts only electricity, and the fees are very small. But it does work, and they are increasing the fees over time. And there's an exciting new initiative on the horizon, the TCI, or the Transportation Climate Initiative, which would extend the fees into the transportation sector, as California has done. And there's also the prospect of the New York ISO, the utility managing agency that are planning a fee on carbon of their own. It's a very exciting prospect that may come to pass in the next couple of years. But the CLCPA is an outgrowth of the CCPA, which was written by the large coalition, New York Renews. They've done a fantastic job in New York State of drawing attention to the need for carbon pricing and especially the need for climate and environmental justice. They are primarily a labor union-backed coalition. They have representatives from a great many community organizations, and they are looking at carbon pricing to achieve many of those ends. And they essentially succeeded in getting this legislation passed. But I will say for CCL New York that at the very end, when compromise was needed between what the governor wanted and what the legislature wanted, I think we helped them to come to a compromise, and so did about 24 other environmental organizations who all signed on to a letter asking for compromise.
Fantastic. All right. We will end on that note. Any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, I'd like to tell them that there is hope. They shouldn't give up hope. And every little bit they can do counts. Don't think you're a hypocrite because you're doing one thing and not another thing. Do whatever you can. And please call, tweet, Facebook. Let your member of Congress know that this is a priority for you.
Perfect. Thank you for joining us, Lynn Meyer, New York State co-coordinator, Citizens Climate Lobby. And we've been talking about the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks, Bob.
And on that note, we are going to end. My name is Bob DiBenedetto. I'm on WUSB 90.1 FM. You can go to WUSB.FM. And I want to thank you for listening to The Healthy Planet. I'll be with you again on Friday, September 20th. That's 2 weeks from now at the same time at 6 p.m. And September 20th is, by the way, 3 days before the UN Climate Summit in New York City. And on that day, young people and adults across the U.S. and the world will strike to demand transformative action be taken to address the climate crisis. Millions are expected to take to the streets. That's on September 20th, and we'll be with you that evening. Be sure to like our Facebook page by looking for Healthy Planet USA. You can go to www.healthyplanetusa.org for past show information coming soon. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and the Healthy Planet shows every week at this time with great hosts sharing cutting-edge information on topics that are going to help you live a more healthful life and be a more active part of society and making us grow into a clean energy economy. That's Fridays at 6 p.m. And until next time, stay strong, keep moving, meditate, relax, make your voice heard in the world by speaking up for what's right, even if the political climate is challenging. Be kind to those around you, including our smart and worthy four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share. Good night.